The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled The Final Days of Rabbi Akiva, is the second of a 12-part series from the fall of Betar to the completion of the Mishnah. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmos Yitzchak ben Avraham, Tzivia bas Yitzchak, Vatoba ben Mendel Aleihem Hasholem, Mr. Irwin Kapler, Mrs. Clarice Wallach, and Mr. Tony Wallach of blessed memory.
One of the greatest teachers of all time was Rabbi Akiva. Much of the basic rabbinic literature, the Mishnah, Sifra, Sifrei, Tosefta, is grounded on his teachings. It would be inconceivable to imagine the Torah world as we know it today if not for his immense contribution. But perhaps even greater than his formal teachings are the lessons he taught us simply by the way he lived. The son of a convert, raised in poverty, this unlettered shepherd, by the dint of his determination and unusual sacrifice of his wife, rose to become the greatest man of his generation. Up to the very last moment of his life, Rabbi Akiva continued to teach and inspire. His very death, with Shema Yisrael on his lips, continues to serve as a model of devotion to Hashem and his Torah. Rabbi Akiva's teachings in life and death are the subject of tonight's lecture. Besides his brilliance and determination, there are two exceptional qualities that Rabbi Akiva possessed that, to this day, continue to make him a source of inspiration for us all: compassion and humility. On the first page of the handouts, we have an incident in Rabbi Akiva's life that the Gemara Nedarim, Daf Mem, 48, quotes, that gives us an insight into Rabbi Akiva and also serves as a source for the halacha, for practical law. We all know that there's a mitzvah to visit the sick. It's beneficial simply for the visit itself to uplift the spirits of the person, of the one who's sick. It's important to see the person and to pray on him for his behalf. But we learn from this following incident of Rabbi Akiva another element of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the sick. Here on the first page, paragraph A. It once happened that one of Rabbi Akiva's disciples fell ill, and the other sages did not visit him. So Rabbi Akiva himself entered his house to visit the student. And because he swept, in other words, it was dirt floors, he swept the floor and sprinkled the ground. In other words, they used to sprinkle the ground with water to keep the dust from rising. He recovered. After he recovered, he came to Rabbi Akiva and he said, "My master, you've revived me. You've given me life." Rabbi Akiva went forth and lectured, "He who does not visit the sick is like a shedder of blood." In other words, by the fact that one does not come and does not see the situation where the sick person is in, where one can lend a helping hand, even one is not a professional, by the act of staying out, so to speak, one is akin to shedding blood. And we learn from this a principle in halacha about about the purpose of visiting the sick, not just merely to take a look and lift up his spirits, but also to be involved actively in the recovery of the sick. But Rabbi Akiva didn't bother him. He went personally to one of his students to do all this manual labor. We find another incident in the life of Rabbi Akiva. This has been quoted in a previous class as relates to Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon was immensely wealthy and also very generous. One time Rabbi Tarfon gave to Rabbi Akiva, according to this this version, it's 600 hundredweights, in other words, 60,000 shkolim of silver. He told him to invest it, go buy a field, and with the profits, so we can we'd use the profits to continue the study of learning. Instead of using the money to buy a field, he went, Rabbi Akiva, and he divided it amongst the Kli Kodesh, the teachers of Scripture and Mishnah, to give them the opportunity of involving themselves in learning. Later on, Rabbi Tarfon was not aware of how Rabbi Akiva had invested his money. And he asked, you know, by the way, like, where's the field that you bought? So Rabbi Akiva replied, do you want me to show it to you? He says, sure. So he took him to these people. He says, you know, these are the... He didn't understand. He thought maybe he had, you know, sold this property of land to all these people, you know, and he asked them, you know, where's the money? And he had to explain it to that the investment was the support of these people. On page 2, we have, this is from one version. This version is taken from the Medrash Rabbah in Vayikra. The other version, Maseches Kala, continues on. And he says, they asked the question, Rabbi Tarfon was a generous person, and he was a very learned person. And he knew about the requirement to support the poor, so in all probability he had already supported the poor. I mean, why did Rabbi Akiva use this ruse, so to speak, to get him to give more money to the poor? And it gives the answer given is with a folk saying, that according to the camel, so is the load. In other words, he was immensely wealthy, but a person blessed with so much wealth has even a greater responsibility to help those who are in need. So even though he gave so much, he still really should have given more. Because of his compassion, Rabbi Akiva's, and because of his brilliance, evidently he knew how to raise funds. There are a few institutions in the city could use a person of those talents. Yeah. He was actually appointed by the Sanhedrin as the official caretaker, the parnas, of the poor. That was his position. The Sanhedrin was not only, this was not a Sanhedrin that dealt with capital crimes that had already ceased, of course, but this was the main nerve center of Jewry. All the questions of law came to this, to the Masifta, the yeshiva. But it was the authoritative source for Jewish law. Rabbi Akiva was a member of that group. But it also was a quasi-government in exile. In the absence of a Jewish government, many of the functions that normally would be taken by a government were fulfilled through this Sanhedrin. In a previous lecture, we've discussed the idea of the Nasi, the prince, the president of the Sanhedrin, was more than just a scholar or a scholar amongst scholars, but was also involved as the representative of the Jewish community to the world at large. In that sense, Rabbi Akiva was appointed as the caretaker, was really appointed by It was basically a quasi-governmental position. All those who are involved in raising funds know about the difficulties. And before he was offered the position, he went to his wife. He said, "I have to ask my wife about this." Went to his wife, and they overheard him speaking to his wife, and he says, "This involves becoming cursed, you know, by people, either those who give or feel that they've been put upon to give, or those who receive and don't feel that they've received enough. It involves being embarrassed. Will you let me take this position, knowing full and well that, you know, that I will, and ultimately it may affect you as well, will be subjected to all of this?" Evidently she did agree. You have to realize this is a woman who was the daughter of one of the wealthiest people of Israel, who, because she married Rabbi Akiva, she saw these tremendous qualities in Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was an unlettered 40-year-old shepherd. She was cut off from her family, lived in abject poverty. In fact, she had to sell her hair. You know, she cut off her hair to sell it for, you know, for use, you know, as a wig, or just to support herself and to support her husband, to enable him to study. So a little being cursed and embarrassed wouldn't have bothered her too much, but he had to go and ask her. There's an incident which is recorded in the Talmud on page 3. Which is with another aspect of his character, his humility. On paragraph F, it describes a time in Israel when there was a lack of rain. And a lack of rain could possibly mean starvation. And after a certain time, when the rain should have begun, and not a series of fasts are proclaimed. And finally, there's first three, there's a, it starts off that scholars on their own start fasting. And if that isn't, they aren't answered, then there are 3 days of fasting which are declared, where they fast, as we do fast, most of our fast days from the morning till night. If there's no results, another 3 days are declared, where they fast 24 hours. And again, if no results, there's another 7 days which are declared. In these 7 days, there are extra prayers which are added to the Shemoneh Esrei. There are 6 extra prayers which are added. And here, rain had not fallen for such a long time. He davened before the Omud, in other words, in front of the Oren. And Rabbi Eliezer, the great teacher, this is Rabbi Kiva's teacher, was the Shliach Tzibur, was the Chazan. And he led in the prayers, and it wasn't answered. Rabbi Kiva stepped after him, and he said, "Avinu Malkeinu." And as soon as he started saying "Avinu Malkeinu," it started raining. And there was a whole stir amongst those presents. And there's the other Rabbana says, you know, why is it Rabbi Eliezer, the great Rabbi Eliezer, his prayers are not answered? And yet Rabbi Akiva's prayers were answered. And the Talmud describes a heavenly voice came out. Said that Rabbi Akiva was answered not because he is a greater tzaddik, not because he's a greater saint, but he is more forbearing, he's more forgiving than Rabbi Eliezer, and it's for that he was answered. Let me just explain this for a moment. Just two basic principles. One is, it seems the way we judge, we are judged. If we are judgmental, if we are particular, in particular on the Midas Hadin, in other words, that we should get everything that we deserve and don't give up an inch. We, and from heaven, says, are treated the same way. We're also judged meticulously. And if we are forgiving and look the other way, and even if we are slighted, we forgive and forget, we likewise are treated the same way and are given, in other words, in divine judgment, we are given the same courtesy, so to speak. This is an incentive, by the way, to have such an attitude. And this is the Chofetz Chaim at length speaks about this. This basically that we are judged the way we judge. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva had two different approaches. Each approach has, of course, its own justification. Rabbi Eliezer was a student of the Yeshiva of Shammai. Shammai, the position of Shammai Hazoka, in other words, Shammai the elder, the leader of the, and this was after his lifetime, but the leader of the Yeshiva, the founder of the Yeshiva, was that in an era that the Torah is taken lightly, and those who teach the Torah are not given the respect that they deserve, it's important to have a demeanor which is more demanding, less forgiving, in the sense that felt that the honor of the Torah itself would be enhanced through such measures. Hillel, the contemporary of Shammai, and Rabbi Akiva, who followed in his footsteps, have felt that, on the contrary, the most effective way to deal with the generation is not with Midas Hadin, in other words, not being meticulous and careful, the honor of Torah, but, on the other hand, perhaps not being so careful with the honor of Torah, showing more love, and that love will generate more honor. Do you look for the honor, or do you look for the love, and the honor will come? People will appreciate it automatically. The approach was a different approach. As Rabbi Saul Salanter maintains, could be that the reason that each one took that approach is strictly from an intellectual view, but not because perhaps they had certain emotional predispositions that Shammai emotionally wanted the path that he took, or Hillel wanted the path that they took. But rather, this was just as they disagreed in other aspects of Jewish law. This was an intellectual argument as to what is the best way that one should act in a capacity of a leader, in a capacity as a teacher. But because Rabbi Eliezer took that path, whatever the justification was, but because he took that path and was meticulous, he can't expect much mercy. Rabbi Akiva, who was willing to become embarrassed, as we said before, and willing to become cursed, and was willing to forgive and to forget and just to show love, he in turn, when the problem arose and he's asking, basically when you're praying, you're asking for compassion, he was the one that was answered. So that's what the boss called the voice from heaven came out. Not that Rabbi Eliezer was less of a saintly person, but because Rabbi Akiva's attitude was such, he was the one to be answered with compassion, not Rabbi Eliezer. But in the process, we do see the way Rabbi Akiva lived his life. It was a life of compassion. Another very important teaching that we have from Rabbi Akiva is his attitude towards suffering. Before we deal with Rabbi Akiva's, again, which touches with his humility, it's just interesting to note that in one of the statements which we have from Rabbi Akiva that deals with with haughtiness. But we sense Rabbi Akiva's attitude towards those who do not have the proper humility. And this is on the bottom of page 3. Rabbi Akiva said, this is in Rabbis Reb Nosson, Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11, anyone who prides himself because of his accomplishments in Torah is similar to a decaying carcass that is thrown on the road. Anyone who passes by puts his hand over his nose and keeps his distance and walks on. And he felt that the role of it's important, the role of the scholar has to be one of humility, because everyone disdains someone that they sense a sense of arrogance, of pride. It's interesting to note, there's a Tosfos in Ksubas that deals, this is Samach Beis Omid Beis in 62b, that deals with Rabbi Akiva's attitudes before he started learning Torah. On one hand, the Talmud teaches us in Ksubas that his wife saw in him tremendous heights of character. There's Tzniu Mali. He was humble, he was modest, and he was full of great character development. On the other hand, there's a quote from Rabbi Akiva that says when he was 40, when before he started learning Torah, from Psachim Mem Tesom Beis 49b. This is before he would learn Torah. If he would see a Talmud Chacham, he would like to bite him like a donkey. So his students, asked, why did you? This is after he was a scholar and was teaching students and describing his attitude before he learned. And his students asked him, why describe biting like a donkey? It should be like a dog. Why a donkey? So the difference is when a donkey bites, it doesn't just bite and leave its teeth marks. It breaks the bones. It's a good crunch. He says, that's the way I felt about scholars. And Tosus poses the question. On one hand, you see such a wonderful person before he started learning Torah. On the other hand, it seems that he had this whole mean streak, this whole hatred. So Tosfos explains that the reason he had that attitude is that he interpreted that the reason the scholars really were aloof, were separate from those who were unlettered, and he attributed it to arrogance, and arrogance is something that he couldn't stand. So it wasn't because of really a meanness, but it was really he misinterpreted, in the sense that they seemed to keep their distance from those who were unlettered, and since it was because of arrogance. So just interesting about Rabbi Akiva's attitude of arrogance here after he became a scholar, and how he felt it so becoming that a scholar really should be one who embodies humility. On page 4, we have a class. This is one of the classic quotes from Rabbi Akiva about his attitude towards suffering. It's interesting. Rabbi Akiva is a person who suffered a lot in his life as well. And he said, "This is we learned in the name of Rabbi Akiva, a person should always be in the habit of saying." Says Kol David Rachmona says Latav of it. Whatever the All Merciful does is for good. And there was an incident in his life which illustrated that attitude. He was once going alone on the road, and he came to a certain town and asked for lodging. Wherever he went, every door he knocked, he was refused. So he took the attitude, whatever Hashem does is for the best. He went and spent the night in the open field, in the forest. He had with him a rooster, so he should wake up early in the mornings before alarm clock. So he had a rooster. He had a donkey to carry his load, and he had a lamp, that he should study by night, or, should have sort of a, should be able to protect him, Anyways, a gust of wind came and blew out the lamp. He's out there in this field or near the forest, They blew out the lamp. A weasel came and ate the rooster. A lion came and ate the donkey. Speaking about bad luck, you know. You know, somebody says, you know, I have to go to my therapist right now. I just can't. It's just too much. No. He said, whatever Hashem does is for the good. That same night, a whole group of brigands, a whole group of these marauding bands came and carried off all the inhabitants of the town. So Rabbi Akiva looked at it and said, you know, as Mark points out, you know, if they had taken him in, you know, as a guest, his fate would be those of all the other people. If on the open field, if they would have seen the lamp, you know, they would have seen they would have come to him. If they would have heard the rooster or heard the braying of the donkey. So all of these saved his life. So he says, didn't I tell you? Says, you know, after telling him, says, whatever Hashem does is for the good. You know, we look at it, it's a... I was recently in Lakewood, and someone made a comment to me. It is amazing. You know, there are many people in life, you know, speaking about those who were in the, you know, in the Beis Medrash and the Yeshiva in Lakewood, you know, they have tremendous talents. If they had the opportunity, those talents would blossom. And if you think about Rabbi Akiva, if you'd see somebody who virtually knew nothing of Torah, he's 40 years old. And if his wife had not prodded him, what a loss it would be for the whole Jewish people. Because this unlettered shepherd grew to be one of the most brilliant scholars in recorded history. The Talmud here on the bottom of page 4, Rabbi Elchanan, who was one of the leading scholars in the era of the Talmud, describes about how the understanding of the generations had diminished. He said, Liban shall Rishonim, the heart of the ancients, is Kapiska shall Ulon, is like the opening of the doorway to the, you know, in the temple, based on Migdosh, there was a courtyard. And then there was the large building, like in the center towards the back. That large building housed the menorah, the shulchan, the special table with the showbread. It had the mizbeach hakteris. It had the golden altar of the, you know, the gilded altar of the for the incense, and it had the kodesh hakadoshim. It had the holy of holies. Before the two rooms that housed the menorah and the holy of holies, there was a ulam, there was a hallway. And that hallway actually was larger than wider than the actual room itself. And the entrance had a width of 20, almost 20 cubits. So let's say a cubit is a foot and a half, so it's like 30 feet. And had a height of 40 cubits. It was like 60 feet. Every other doorway in the temple had a width of 10 and a height of 20. So the size was four times as large. Notice it was twice as wide and twice as tall as any other entranceway. So describing, says, Rabbi Akiva's heart, his ability to assimilate knowledge and to think, you know, his the heart in terms of his sensitivity and his alertness could be compared to the opening of the ulam, the vestibule, this hallway, this enormous But the latter generation, which are really Rabbi Akiva's students, was like the door of the Heichal. The later generation was like the Heichal, the sanctuary, when which was 20 high and 10 wide. We, the opening of our hearts, is like the eye of a fine needle. Just a little. Rabbi Akiva's class among the ancients, Rabbi Elozar ben Shemua, that was Rabbi Akiva's, one of Rabbi Akiva's students, his class is among the last generations. But Rabbi Akiva was looked upon as the symbol of brilliance. And he had a unique way of assimilating information. And Obus Rav Nosson described the different qualities of the different sages. Rabbi Akiva, he called Rehuda a storehouse with compartments. Rabbi Akiva could be best likened to a worker who goes outside with his basket. He finds wheat, he puts it in the basket. Everything is rangamish. And as a barley, he finds spelt. And as he goes around, he finds a little bit, puts it in the basket. When they're in the basket, they're all mixed up. Later on, this is when he comes home, then he starts sorting it into different piles. And this first, the person just is busying himself filling it up, and afterwards he starts separating it. Says Rabbi Akiva had an open mind. Whatever he would listen to, he would want to hear everything. And afterwards, he would take the time to remember what he'd studied and to classify it. Put this here and this there. And this one over here. It's like your computer a little bit. I don't know what you powered it, but it was a powerful computer. But he had the ability to take in all this information and to classify it. So this fitted with this, and that fitted with that. You know, very often we hear all kinds of things, but we don't see the connections. We don't put it together. So he would first study anything he would get hold of. Then afterwards, he would say, how does this fit? Where does this fit? Where can I put it? What is it attached to? That was the uniqueness of his, as a student of his mind. But his perception was unusual as well. The Gemara in Menachos and Chof Tesla in 29b brings the story, evidently it must be an ancient tradition, that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to heaven, this is when he went up the 40 days to receive the Torah, he saw, the vision that he saw was that the letters of the Torah, the letters of the Torah have crowns. Various letters have crowns. And he's putting the crowns, at least in the vision form, on the letters. And he says, what do you need? In other words, what more information? Evidently, these crowns add to the body of the Torah. He says, what more do you need? In other words, what do you have everything? What do you have to add these Torah? What do you have to add these crowns for? So he says that there's a man who is destined to emerge after many generations, and Akiva ben Yosef is his name. He will extract from each and every prong of these crowns mounds and mounds of halachos, tilei tilei shel halachos, these whole mounds of halachos, that he will be able to see in the whole framework of the Torah where everything, all of this Torah shebaal peh, all this immense body of knowledge that was handed down is alluded to in the Torah. That's because we know there's the Torah Shebaal Peh, this tremendous body of knowledge was given to the Jewish people through Moshe. And there's a Torah Shebiksav, the written law. And the written law, it says, are like notes, are like shorthand for this whole immense body of knowledge. Rabbi Akiva was able to decipher the code of the shorthand and to be able to see where it could be reconstructed. Why it was important for Rabbi Akiva is that Rabbi Akiva lived in the period of the Shikhas HaTorah, when the Torah began to become forgotten because of all the persecutions. How many scholars were killed. The environment, the times were not conducive for serious study, which you need time and you need quiet, not in the situation of turmoil. So Rabbi Akiva had the gift of being able to, even in a time when Torah was the original Torah Shebaal Peh, was partially forgotten, to reconstruct it through his insights in decoding the Torah Shebiksav, the written law. So here we find Rabbi Akiva with the open heart, the open mind. Rabbi Akiva had the ability, like the computer, to sort and to arrange. And Rabbi Akiva had the insight and the brilliance, the originality, to really to uncover this whole code. This was Rabbi Akiva. There's another tradition about Rabbi Akiva, as Rabbi Akiva the mystic. This session doesn't lend itself to, you know, to a whole study of the pardes, this mystic knowledge and experience Rabbi Akiva had. We are going to speak in 4 weeks a little more about this. Four men of Rabbi Akiva's generation were said to have entered the Pardes, which it seems to mean really had this mystic, like out of body experience, that their consciousness entered the other world. Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher, this is Elisha ben Avuya, and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said to them, and this is a Kabbalistic thing, when you arrive at the stones of pure marble, say not water, water. In other words, basically everything that you're going to see in this vision cannot be taken at face value. Don't make mistakes. Ben Azai cast a look. In other words, he had this evidently he looked, or he kind of where he shouldn't have, and died. Ben Zoma looked and became demented. Elisha ben Avuya, which is known as Acher, the other one, and we're going to explain in 4 weeks in the lecture about why he was given that name, mutilated the shoots. This kotzas benetias. It's called pardes, which is a thing which also means an orchard. So therefore about destroying to destroy the orchard, so to speak. What he saw, he thought that he saw, was really two gods. As we're going to explain, at least the sources seem to strongly suggest that after his experience, Acher became a dualist, would seem to be, since he became an early Christian. And what he saw mystically supported that belief. So each one went in a different path. Rabbi Akiva was nichnas b'sholom, v'yotza b'sholom. He entered with peace, he departed peace, he departed unhurt. There are many great people. As we've seen, Rabbi Akiva was a person of humility and compassion, brilliance, very spiritual person, but don't have the blessings, or whatever the reason, to have children that go in their ways. Rabbi Akiva was additionally blessed that he had children of stature as well. We have on various occasions, you look on page 7, we're just going to touch upon the advice that he gave his son, Rabbi Yeshua. Notice, to get a title, Rabbi, one has to be appointed it's a judgeship. One has to be able to be a member of the Sanhedrin and to deal with laws, at least when they do, where you need a group of people who are official appointees of the court. So his son, Rabbi Yeshua, was of that level. Not everyone is very few really of the scholars, even of all the many students ever reached the level that they reached, this level of smicha, of this, not the ordination that we have today, but in the time of the Talmud, it was an appointment as a judge. So but his son was Rabbi Yehoshua. So again, he gives him what's recorded as really advice that he, as a father would give to a son. We find that he had a daughter who also went in a similar way as her mother before, that married a scholar, even though that the scholar left home and went many years without leaving his wife. And this is something which we've touched in a previous lecture about Rabbi Akiva, the idea of one asks what kind of a marriage is this? That they have the wife and then they leave them for this continued study. And basically what it seems that it isn't, it's the idea that in order for this person to grow to be a scholar, he has to be totally, he has to, his attention has to be 24 hours a day to be totally focused towards Torah. But the fact is that he has a wife that's, whenever he wants, gives him that sense of security, you know, and that sense of that he's able to keep on pushing off the time that he comes home. And that's where Rabbi Akiva studied 12 years and another 12 years. And his daughter, likewise, was willing to go through the same sacrifice. There's a fascinating story with his daughter, which illustrates not only what kind of a person his daughter was, but a basic tenet of Judaism. The Talmud, in towards the end of the tractate in Shabbos, Kuf Nun Vov in 156, deals with the idea of mazel, you know, of fate. You know, and the approach the Talmud has is that there is mazel. In other words, a person could, and if you would know, you know, when the person is born or whenever, one would know the path that a person's life would take. There are many stories, and I don't have the skill, but there are many stories of people who have the ability to read palms, who could look at a person and say what path this person is going to take. The Talmud, the Gemara, it seems to assume this idea that there is a certain predetermined path that one's life will take. That path does not, of course, say if the person will be a saint or a sinner. That's in a person's free will. But his wealth, his intelligence, all of this is his married life and his children are all just predetermined. That's what's known as mazel. But the Talmud makes the statement that Yisrael, the Jewish people, are lamaylam in our mazel. That they are above mazel. In other words, they can merit because of their saintliness or prayer, they could merit that it may be changed. In other words, God normally will not interfere with this course that a person's life will take. If a person is destined to be a pauper for whatever reason it is, God normally will not interfere with this. But for a Jew, that's a special relationship God has with the Jewish people, that God will involve himself for the person's life if the person is worthy of this. And to be worthy of this, of course, is either this tremendous prayer or inordinate compassion that's shown by the person, that the person is worthy for God's intervention. And as we said before, that God deals with us the way we deal with the world. If we intervene with the world and want to change the world for the good, God will change our life for the good. That's when we wish somebody mazel tov, I mean, what are we wishing? And as we really want, we're praying that if the mazel is good, well, it's still good. But if it's bad, it should be changed for the good. It's a prayer. Because there's mazel, which is this sense, this predetermination, but we want it to be changed. We want the mazel, the flow of life, should be for the good. So it's really a prayer. It's a prayer for the change of mazel. In illustrating the idea how someone's mazel could change, the Gemara quotes, is on page 7 here on the bottom. the story of Rabbi Akiva's daughter. Rabbi Akiva had a daughter. The astrologers told him that the day she enters the bridal chamber, a snake will bite her and she will die. It's all in the stars. He was very worried about this, but he had faith in God. On the day of marriage, she took out a brooch. This was a pen or something with a pin in it, and stuck it into the wall. They don't have walls like that in West Bloomfield, but the walls were such that you could stick it into them. And by chance, it penetrated into the eye of a serpent. There happened to be a snake there. She wasn't aware of it. She stuck it in. Then she took it off. And she went to the chasana. Following morning, when she took it out, now she wanted the brooch again. I need it now. She took it out, and this venomous snake came out with the brooch. So her father asked her, says, what did you do? Like, did anything unusual happen that day? Yeah, says, a poor man came to our door in the evening, she replied. And everyone was busy at the banquet. In other words, this was the chasana, and there was no one to attend to him. So I took the portion which was given to me, and I gave my portion and gave it to him. So she really didn't eat that night, because she gave her portion to this poor man. So he says that deed saved your life. Because he says, tzedakah tatzel min moves. Charity saves from death. It's like this. And even though it was predestined, so to speak, at least this is Rabbi Akiva's view as well, that was she was supposed to die, that merit changed the mazel. But then it gives you a sense of what kind of a daughter Rabbi Akiva had and what kind of a person Rabbi Akiva was that had such a daughter. We've stated before that Rabbi Akiva started his studies when he was 40 years old, after being a shepherd. According to historians, the approximate day, the date of the birth of Rabbi Akiva, was in the year 118 of the Common Era. At 40 years old, when he started studying then, was the year 58. Of the Common Era. He had already 24,000 disciples, which puts it in the year 82. The year 82 was the beginning of the reign of Domitian, who was the Vespasian was the general, later the Caesar, that conquered the temple. He reigned from the year 69 to the year 79. When he died, his son Titus, the one, the general who actually was in charge when the temple was destroyed, became the emperor for 2 years, from the year 79 to the year 81. In the year 81, Domitian, another son of Vespasian, a brother of Titus, became emperor. In those years, this was where Rabbi Akiva started blossoming. The Sifri explains that Rabbi Akiva's interim period, he was 40 years, he was a shepherd. For 40 years, he was a student, even though he was a teacher, of course, but he didn't have an official position in the Sanhedrin as one of the official teachers. He just taught on his own. See, bar mitzvah lessons, 24,000, that's a lot. No, that he was on his own, because he was, besides the Masifta, in other words, the Sanhedrin, which was the major center of all scholars, every one of these scholars had their own, had their own yeshivas, their own beisdin, their own court of law, and their own cities. And those Rabbi Akiva was a teacher, was a Rosh Hashiva, was a Dayan, was the head of a rabbinic court, while at the same time being a member of the Sanhedrin, but not a dominant member, not in a position of real leadership. That took place when he was 80 years old. When he was 80 years old, that takes us to the year 98 of the Common Era. That was that marks the end of the reign of Domitian and the beginning of the reign of Nerva. Nerva was this philosopher, emperor, who reigned for a very short period of time, and after his death, Trajan reigned. Trajan was, 2 weeks ago, Trajan was responsible for the destruction of the communities. This is in Alexandria, North Africa, and Cyrenia, Cyprus, and, wrought much destruction in Babylon. And it was in this terrible period, the reign of Trajan, that Rabbi Akiva took on this new position of leadership. But perhaps one of the most trying situations he had as a leader was dealing with Turnus Rufus. Here we have him, page 8. Trajan was the emperor from the year 98. In the year 117, he died, 118. 118, Hadrian became emperor. 4 years later, Hadrian visited Jerusalem, and as we've explained this 2 weeks ago in the last lecture, wanted to convert Jerusalem into a pagan city and the place where the temple originally was, the Beis HaMikdash, to make a pagan temple to the main Roman god, which was one of the major causes of the revolt which ended in the debacle of Bar Kokhba. According to the church sources, according to Eusebius, the Roman governor was Rufus. This is Turnus Rufus. And Rabbi Akiva is now the leader of the Jewish people. This is in the year, now we're doing the year 122. And on, was in a position to deal directly with the head of the Romans. So here you have the head of the Jews, Rabbi Akiva, dealing with the head of the Romans. And the relationship was perhaps cordial, but not very pleasant. Turnus Rufus was a student of Judaism, and as such gave Rabbi Akiva a very tough time, because he was a pagan student of Judaism. And it's recorded many of their sparrings, in other words, the give and take between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva has been recorded for us. And we just want to touch upon some of them here. On page 8, we have the question that Turnus Rufus gave to Rabbi Akiva. And he asked them, well, if your God loves the poor, and as you say, why doesn't he support them? In other words, why are the Jews required to support the poor? Well, if God cared about them, he would support them himself. Evidently, God doesn't care too much about these people. Well, if he wants them to be damned, how do you help them? You know, it's very similar to the idea that the Brahmins have to the untouchables. These people are damned, so what do you have to do with them? So Rabbi Akiva answers, on the contrary, is this which says, Turnus Rufus says, you know, really you shouldn't, you, for supporting them, says you should be condemned to Gehenna, you know, to be condemned to purgatory. You know, if you had helped, if someone had condemned, if the emperor had condemned someone to put in prison and starve to death, and you would be helping him, you'd be aiding and abetting a prisoner that had been sentenced, it would be an act of treason. It would be a crime. So Rabbi Akiva answered, I'll illustrate by another parable. Suppose an earthly king was angry with his son and put him in prison, ordered that no food or drink should be given to him, and someone went and gave him food and drink.
You know, the king would still, I mean, the king has a lot of mixed emotions. On one, he had this fit of anger and wanted to send his kid into the prison. But on the other hand, it's his son. So if you help that, says this king will still remember you for good. So he said, Turnus Rufus evidently was a student of the Bible. And he says, you know, Jews are called servants and sons. He says, you know, sometimes you're just merely servants and not sons, you know. When you're not fulfilling God's will, you're servants, you're not sons. God doesn't have that that warm feeling towards you anymore. So Rabbi Akiva brought him again, he says, brought him a verse to explain, says that even in these times, we should support the poor. But it's interesting, Rabbi Akiva's attitude was that God is giving us an opportunity to do chesed. Whatever the reason that these people were condemned to suffer, but he wants us to intervene in their lives. And that is really the Jewish attitude. Turnus Rufus really shows the pagan attitude. Charity is really a Jewish, is really very Jewish. Even to this day in India, those who are involved in charity to the poor are those of the Christian orders. Mother Teresa is a Catholic nun. The idea of charity of her is a very Jewish concept, not a pagan concept. There's a whole thing, page 9, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Samachay and the Aleph, about how they were sparring about how do you know which day is Shabbos. Because again, this is like it touched the very essence of Jewishness. He asks, says, how do you know? Says, he asks, says, why, Turnus Rufus says, why does God demand that every Jew should circumcise his son? Well, if God wanted them to be circumcised, he would have made them circumcised. And again, which shows the very Jewish attitude that God put us on this earth to change the earth. Because we are not made whole, we recreate ourselves. The pagan attitude is you basically roll with the punches. In other words, you are what you are, and that's it. You blend in with nature. You're one with nature. You don't change nature. Don't make any waves. Don't make any ripples. Turnus Rufus again is showing the whole pagan attitude. You are just you. The Jewish attitude is you can change yourself and you can change the world. Turnus Rufus came up with a brilliant plan of how to defeat Rabbi Akiva, his enemy. And just like Bilaam before him wanted to, felt that the way to undercut Jewry is to destroy their morals, Turnus Rufus had a beautiful wife and felt that if his wife would seduce him, it would undercut their whole, Rabbi Akiva's whole authority, and really would make the Jews more pliable. You have to realize, as we explained last time, according to Roman sources, and it seems according to Jewish sources as well, during this time, the reign of Turnus Rufus, when he was governor of Judea, Hadrian had already started promulgating these decrees that the Jews should assimilate. And the Jews were resisting. And this, of course, is one of the reasons of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. So Turnus Rufus felt it would be very helpful in his fight to demoralize Jewry if he would be able to seduce Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva saw her. His reaction was, he spat, he laughed, and then he started crying. And the Gemara really records that he made a bracha, he made a benediction of the shekochol ba'olomoy, that Hashem had made such beautiful things in this world. But he spat because, like, beauty is, you know, it's originally only from a putrefying drop. It's only an illusion. He cried because such a beauty should ultimately decay in the dust about her demise. But he laughed because he foresaw that she would eventually become a proselyte. She would become a geuris and would take her to be a wife. She was not successful in trying to seduce Rabbi Akiva. But evidently, when she saw Rabbi Akiva, she went home and saw her tzatzka, and they saw Turnus Rufus. The marriage was not long, was not... Eventually, they were divorced, she embraced Judaism, and she married Rabbi Akiva. Now, that did not do very much for the relations between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. If they were bad before, they really not really improved. As we went last time, the Jews waged at one time a very successful revolt against the Romans. There's evidence to say that they actually conquered Jerusalem. Hadrian brought his best and brightest. He brought Julius Severus, who was the head of the legion in Britain, with many other heads of legions to come. And by slowly destroying one at a time the fortresses of the Jews, they're able to pin them down into Betar, and eventually they were all slaughtered. And afterwards, they felt the only way to deal with the Jews was to deal even more oppressively with them. And they forbade the public study of Torah. Just interesting to note that even though we have sources which we quoted last time, that Rabbi Akiva was supportive of the revolt, the Romans did not look at him as a leader of the revolt. And Rabbi Akiva in the aftermath was not implicated as part and parcel of the revolt. And as Rabbi Akiva's comments about Bar Kokhba, that he saw him as Mashiach, was that of a scholar. In other words, this is the Rambam points out, that he felt that there was enough evidence to support the idea that he is, we can, under the assumption of being Mashiach. But when he was defeated, but he wasn't one who, it seems, he wasn't actively in support of Bar Kokhba. He wasn't a person who drummed up, as other historians would say, that he went in fundraising for it, or to go and to bring support. If he would be involved, then he would have been guilty, and the Romans would have been after Rabbi Akiva in the aftermath of the defeat of Bar Kokhba. Evidently, he was viewed as a gentle scholar, and not part of the revolt. However, they had, in order to tighten their grip on the Jewish people, they forbade the open study of Torah. In other words, as Rabbi Akiva, in his position, was constantly teaching openly to whole throngs of Jews Torah. And this was forbidden, and Rabbi Akiva flouted their rules and still was teaching. On page 11, we have the Popas Ben Yehuda, who we know from other sources was a great communal leader, found Rabbi Akiva teaching publicly after the Romans. This is after the fall of Betar. The fall of Betar is, according to historians, is somewhere between the year 133 and the year 135. And he was still teaching Torah. He says, Akiva, why aren't you afraid of the government? And he replied, let me explain to you with a parable. A fox was walking alongside a river, and he saw fish going in swarms from one place to another. And the fox asks the fish, why are you fleeing? He says, from the nets, the fishermen. He said, you know what? Why don't you come up to dry land? I'll take good care of you, you know? And we'll both live together as our ancestors lived with your ancestors. As the Marshal points out, that was also Baba Meissen. In other words, that also was, but that's all part of his ruse of the fox. You know, we're all the same. And says the fish replies, says, "You're supposed to be the cleverest of all animals," and this is as shrewd as a fox. "You're not clever, but foolish. If we're afraid in the element in which we live, how much more in the element which we would die? We have, at least there's some hope. As long as we're in water, we're going to survive. Once we leave water, there's no hope of survival." He says the secret of the survival of the Jewish people is the study of Torah. It's kuchayecho v'ruchyomecho. It's your life, the length of your days. If we go and neglect it, how much worse off we shall be. In other words, we may survive as human beings, but the Jewish people without Torah cannot survive. It was related that soon after Rabbi Akiva was arrested, and Pappas ben Yehuda was also arrested. And Pappas told him, says, "Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva, how fortunate you are. At least you're being killed for a positive reason." Pappas evidently is not saying for what reason he was, but he was, but it wasn't for something that he would consider himself a martyr for. Rabbi Akiva was taken out for execution. He was taken, and he was, and just summarily killed. He was tortured to death. And again, it's not clear from the sources, was the torture just part of the punishment, or they had really, they felt that the torturing would cause him, under the influence of the torture, to publicly, in other words, anything, just stop the torture, and to publicly regret his commitment to Torah. They would use him as just as they tried in the Inquisition, to use these people under torture to really influence others. In other words, if he would now, says, under torture, say that he regrets all that he has done, it would be a tool in the hands of the Romans for them to influence the others. So it's not clear, was the torture just simply a punishment, or it was a means to an end, and it's not clear from the sources. But before we go into his actual death, just remember that during the period while he was a prisoner, which seems to be for some length of time, it is recorded the goings on. There's an incident which we have on page 12. It's taken from a Gemara in Erevin, 21b, about the time when he was in prison. He had a servant, Rabbi Shua Hagarsi. Again, if he's called Rabbi, we're dealing with a man of great, great knowledge. He was appointed already as a judge, who was attending him, and they gave him just a certain amount of water each day. There was always a fear to give too much water to prisoners. They pour the water in, make the ground soft, and start digging tunnels. He was carrying in water. The prison keeper looked at him, "You have too much water." And he says, he wanted to build a house, and he poured out half of it. So he only came with half of the amount of water. So he says, "Listen, I need the water to wash my hands before I eat bread." That's from Tilas Yadayim. He says, "But you need it more important for you to drink." He says, "Listen, I can't violate," says, "this rabbinic enactment that you can't eat bread before you wash your hands. I'm not going to, even at the point of death, and he washed his hands with the water that he had, and he ate bread, and there was very little for him to drink. And the sages remarked, if he was so scrupulous in his old age, how much more when he was young? And if it is a matter of when he was in a prison, if he wasn't in the prison, how much more so that he was careful to in his observance of Torah. You see what kind of a person he was, even in these most difficult situations. It's also recorded that during the time that he was asked questions, and even though he wasn't allowed to teach Torah, you can look for yourself on page 13. There's a whole story about a very complicated issue in halacha that he was able to relay the message of what his ruling was when it wasn't obvious to the authorities. But finally, the time came that he was sentenced to death. The Gemara in Brachos describes this When Akiva was taken out for execution, it was the hour of the recital of Shema. While they combed his flesh with iron combs, in other words, they pulled off his the language of the Gemara and Menachos is that they pulled it off and they waited to be sold, you know, in the market to give it for dog food or whatever. They combed his, and he was saying Shema. He says, and his students asked him, even to this point, in other words, you're saying, evidently he's not giving, either it's not clear what it means. It means not giving into the torture. Or he's able even to concentrate, even in this tremendous pain, to still be davening. And he says, all my days have been troubled by this verse, with all thy soul, b'chol nafshecha, which I interpret means, even if they take your soul, you should still love God. Even the most difficult situation, you should still love God. Because I said it all the time, I didn't have the opportunity of fulfilling it. Now I have the opportunity of fulfilling this mitzvah. And as evidently he's under torture, and he's not bending under the torture. He says, I shouldn't be happy. The Yerushalmi quotes this story, the Talmud Yerushalmi. It says that when it happened on page 15, he started laughing, Rabbi Akiva, and Turnus Rufus couldn't take it. Turnus Rufus was not only one that he was his torturer. He says, are you a sorcerer? Someone delights in resisting. You're a masochist. Says, how could you laugh while you're being tortured? And again, he explains, says that this is the opportunity, says that I love God with all my, says in the most difficult situations. And as the Gemara says in Brachas, when he said the Echod by Shema, his soul left him. The Shema Yisrael Shem Elokeinu, Shem Echod, the hero Israel, says the Lord, says our God, the Lord is one, says when he said one, his soul left. On page 16, we have the record from the Maseches Smachos that when he was killed in Caesarea. Now, when I went to Israel, they rebuilt the amphitheater in Caesarea in Caesarea, which overlooks the sea. And they claim it's quite possible that this, by the amphitheater, was the place where he was tortured. The news reached Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava and Hananiah ben Trajan, who were amongst the surviving sages of the period. He says Rabbi Akiva was not killed because of thievery, because in toil and Torah. He was killed to be a sign to us of the approaching doom. This is their. That if Rabbi Akiva dies, this is the beginning of tremendous retribution. And even though it seems this is in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, it seems that only those originally who were involved directly with the rebellion in Beitar were killed or sold as slaves. The other Jews who were not non-combatants were spared. But Rabbi Akiva's death marked the beginning of a new era of suppression. Since there were no, at least according to this interpretation, that they had been totally plundered within the next 12 months, and it seems during this time beginning that even the other great sages were put to death. Rabbi Akiva's death has a special place in our literature. On the last page here, on page 17, we quote about the loss of a person of such stature. This is on paragraph L. Rabbi Akiva died, the power of Torah ceased, and the fountains of wisdom were stopped up. It was a loss for Jewry in general. We have lost a teacher of such stature, such a source of inspiration. But as it seems from the sources, that his death, it seems, has a place, was predicted long before he came into this world. On page 14, we have when Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moses saw this vision of Rabbi Akiva. First he saw Rabbi Akiva, I think, of the future history, and Rabbi Akiva says, teaching. And he sat behind, as this vision of 8 rows behind the students. And he couldn't follow the arguments of Rabbi Akiva. It was so beyond, again, this is the beginning of Moshe Rabbeinu before he had studied all the Torah. And it was beyond him. And then when, but the students asked, what is the source of this? Rabbi Akiva replied, well, it's Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. It was the law given to Moses at Sinai, which he had not heard yet. This Moshe Rabbeinu, he began the 40 days. He was comforted, it's more coming. But he says, but he was amazed by his wisdom, his insight. And Moshe's reply to Ribbono Shel Olam says, Lord of the universe, you have such a person, you're giving Torah by me? But he felt that Rabbi Akiva was a superior. He says, be silent, for such is my decree, that you are the given, the conduit of Torah, but Rabbi Akiva is the one who will be able to fathom its depths. Because basically Moshe Rabbeinu was really a conduit. He was just given all this information. He had to develop it himself. He was told all of this, and he taught it to the Jewish people. And basically, up until the time of Rabbi Akiva, it was kept intact. In the time of Rabbi Akiva, it was important, in a time of forgetting of the Torah, to be able to reconstruct this, because the original Masorah, the original tradition, because of all the persecution, was not kept in its fullness. So you needed a person of Rabbi Akiva's stature to reconstruct it. Then Moshe continued and he said, you've shown me his Torah, what is his reward? And he says, turn thee around, said he, like to another projector, I guess. And he saw them weighing out his flesh at the market stalls. In other words, they really were cutting off pieces of Rabbi Akiva. This is Lord of the universe, Zuter v'Zuschora, this is the Torah, and this is reward. And again, be silent, that is the decree. We find by Odom Harishon, again, it brings another medrash, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah and Daf Hei, Odom Harishon, the first man, saw Rabbi Akiva. And also he had the same attitude. He was happy with his Torah, but he was saddened with his death. And really his death, and really the death of the other martyrs, but his death especially, seems the one which creates this whole question, how could God allow such suffering? And why should a person of that stature deserve such suffering? I would just like to share with you the explanation of the Vilna Gaon to this, the Rabbi Akiva's suffering. And then we'll open the floor to questions. Rashi, in the beginning of the Torah, quotes the Medrash that originally God wanted to create the world b'midas hadin, with the attribute of justice. And he saw the world can't exist with just din, with just justice. Simply because it would be so hard for people have to grow, and as if they're immediately punished after they do anything wrong, it leaves no place for growth. It leaves no place for free will. If everyone knows that every time you say something bad about somebody, say Lashon Hara, you're zapped. You don't have much free will about saying Lashon Hara. Speaking ill of others. in a similar sense, it's important to have free will that justice not be meted out immediately. So Shitif Imoy Midas Harachamim, he combined the attribute of compassion. So the world, there's compassion and there's justice. But the original machshava, the original thought, was to create a world with pure justice. There are individuals, though, in this world that God can act with them in pure justice. These are the tzaddikim, these special people that have really worked their whole lives to such a state that if they see clearly justice in this world, there's no question of lack of free will. They've already earned it through their life. There are people that could sustain this. They won't lose their faith because of this. People that are the problem of God giving justice in the world, the person's immediate reaction is, why me? I'm so good. I don't deserve this. Rabbi Kiva, who always says, Kol ma'adav rachmon latava, but everything that God does is for the good, if he has that attitude, he's a person who can accept suffering and accept justice. Rabbi Kiva, for whatever slight misdemeanors he may have done in this life, Midas Hadin, in other words, the attribute of justice, would demand that he suffer. And this is the Olam Machshav Lefonai. This is the thought that originally God created the world. There be people here that earn their keep, that are treated with justice, but who have earned everything. And it's these people who sustain the whole world. This is the Gemara by Chanina ben Dosa, that he was the great saint, that the whole world is fed because of his merit. Kol olam nizam mishul Chanina b'ni. But Chanina b'ni, Chanina isn't able to support. He only has a kav from like a quart, the size of a quart of carob, for a whole week. He just subsists. He lives b'midas hadin. He lives with the attribute of justice. He gets only what he deserves. Because of that, there's compassion towards the whole world. So there are people who earn their keep, the Rabbi Kivas, the Chanina ben Dosas of the world, and there's us. We exist because of, or me, we exist because of them. And this is the end. This is how the Vilna Gaon explains that this is kach, this is shtogdom, be quiet, kach ol machshov lefonai. This is the thought that came to, in other words, is a reference to this original thought. The same wording is that originally God thought to create the world with justice. This is the justice. Because there are people who earn their keep, he could, in other words, this is basically, it's like, those who are teachers in the audience, if you give a test and everybody fails, it's a poor reflection on the teacher. At least somebody's got to get an A. Somebody has to pass this course and do well with the course. And everybody else, okay, they're the nachshlepers, and they're the people who are also in the, whatever they get is fine. The world was created for the Rabbi Akivas. And Rabbi Akiva made himself. It isn't, he wasn't born a Rabbi Akiva. He came from behind, so to speak. But the world was made for those people who turn out to be Rabbi Akivas. Because there are people like them around, God tolerates people, other people. So Rabbi Akiva's death is viewed as this, there was a Midas Hadin in the world. There was a time that God demanded justice. To tell us that God demanded that there's a critical time in history. It's a time to do tshuva. It's a time that the sins of Jews had reached a critical mass, so to speak. As we explained, that this whole period from the destruction of the temple till the destruction of Beitar, the whole Bar Kokhba revolution, destruction of Alexandria, was all part of one process. This was the culmination of that process. The 10 martyrs are really part of this whole long process. Next 2 weeks, we will discuss further the death of the others of the 10 martyrs, the end of the Hadrianic era, the beginning of the rebuilding of the Torah institutions in Israel. And now, we'll open to any questions. The word, the question of what the term mavir, mida really means measure. This is a confine, it's a measure. The measure of the person would be, the normal thing would be to, the normal reflex would be, if someone embarrasses you, is to lash out. That's the normal human attribute. That's the normal human. The maver al midos of one who goes beyond, who squashes his normal reaction, so to speak, and lets his head rule over his heart. He does that which is, in other words, even though he knows because of his honor that he would love to have the sweet sense of vengeance to go and embarrass the person back, just to punish the person for having punished him, but his sense of kindness overwhelms the other sense. So we have two parts of your body. There's one that wants to be kind and good, the other that wants to be vengeful. And you're able to overcome, the natural inclination. The language used in the Gemara and Brachas and Dav Zion is by Rabbi when Rabbi Shmuel, the high priest, came to the Holy of Holies. He prayed that God, again, should, his midas harachem, his compassion, should be, the language mavra midoiso, is that should overwhelm the normal sense of justice. So if someone has that attitude, God treats him in a similar way, that God's compassion overwhelms the justice. Okay, that was the easy one. Right. Any resemblance I think is merely coincidental. There is a difference between the attitude of the 10 martyrs about their dying because of our sins and the founder of Christianity's dying for the sins of mankind. In the Christian version, he is looked as the pure lamb who is the human sacrifice. And it's an atonement. You know, like Yom Kippur comes and atones you. It's an atonement. Wipes all the sins thing. St. Peter's standing there by the pearly gates to let you in because you have let him be your korban, your sacrifice. That's the Christian view. So he really washes your sins away. According to this view is really that a person's sins normally will be judged in some venue, in some court of law. A person will have to give an accounting for all his actions. The idea of compassion is that God gives you another chance. He's Mara, he's Erech HaPayim. He does not immediately demand justice, but rather is compassionate, gives you more than you deserve, hoping that you will rise to the occasion. You don't deserve all this TLC, and this, you don't deserve all of this, but he nonetheless is hopeful and will do this. Why he's able to tolerate all our shortcomings and misdemeanors and say, well, the world is not worth it, like, you know, nobody's doing anything here, is because there are people who earn their keep. So, He is not forgiving our sins. He's tolerating it and hoping that we will change, but eventually there will be a time of justice and a time of accounting. He is basically putting it off. Okay, because of Rabbi Akiva. Yeah, and the third question.
Would you have to be a tzaddik or a rasha to make a
Yeah, well, this deals with the question about the free will of Rabbi Akiva. If they've seen already such a tzaddik and he's doing all of this, this really touches upon a very difficult problem, which really I think was beyond human ken, about the idea of free will and God's knowledge. It's interesting. The word Rabbi Akiva is not just the, you know, as we look to Rabbi Akiva, other Mauritians saw all of the leaders of mankind. So everybody is there. You know, it's interesting, the you know, in the, I'm not familiar with the codes of the Torah, you know, the Arachim in the codes of the Torah, they were able to find, they went through, I guess they found the names in Jewish encyclopedia, I don't know, but the names of the great rabbinical scholars of history, and found their names encoded, you know, with the equidistant thing, their names and the time of their death. All in, there's their name and their death. It's an amazing thing. Evidently, this is the Sefer of the Mauritian. It's all encoded. So they're all there. So it really, it's part of this problem, which is really beyond, you know, the fact that it was humans to understand. Yes. Yeah. I noticed when I was, when I was giving this class, a lot of the women were getting a little nervous here. It's you know, an atypical marriage. That really is true. Basically, they were totally engrossed as students. But it was important for their psychological well-being to know that there's always somebody waiting for them. If they didn't have that, it would be like in Lakewood, you know, they would tap them on the shoulder, you're looking for a shidduch, you know what I mean? So, you know, it's like, you know, there's always you know, there was all this. You know, the person is a naturally have the natural inclination is for people to be married, and it goes really beyond the natural thing to not be married. So, for them to be celibate and to learn really is something which is like, you know, just it goes against the human nature. However, it says if they are married, and basically you take a day at a time. You say, you know, today I'm learning, you know, and tomorrow I'll go back home, you know. Then it's the next day, and the next day, and the next day. You can go for 24 years. I'm not, you know, telling anybody here. I know a lot of nervous people. But their role as wives was really just to be always waiting for them, and that enabled them psychologically to keep on learning. Again, it is really an atypical marriage, you know.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.